This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is General Tommy Franks. He led the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq as the commander-in-chief of CENTCOM, the U.S. Central Command. He served in that position from July of 2000 until retiring from the military in July 2003. In his new memoir, American Soldier, General Franks writes about planning and executing those wars. He also looks back on his earlier military career, fighting in Vietnam, and serving as an assistant division commander during Operations Desert Storm and Desert Shield. General Franks, welcome to Fresh Air. You write in your new book that on September 12th you started planning the attack against Afghanistan. How soon did you start planning the attack against Iraq?
The first time that I ever really got serious, and of course I talk about it in the book at some length, was during December 2001. It's always interesting to me that so many people say, well, you know, this president was consumed on the subject of Iraq immediately following 9/11, and I think Dick Clark made that point in his book. And I've told a lot of people that that may be true, but the president of the United States knew who the military commander responsible for Iraq was. And the first time he talked to me about it was the end of December 2001.
What was the reason you were given for invading, you know, for planning an invasion against Iraq?
Actually, the president never asked me whether I thought we should conduct military operations in Iraq. I've always found that interesting, because if he had asked me, I would have said, of course, because I was responsible for the young men and women who were flying Operation Southern Watch and Operation Northern Watch over Iraq every day for about 10 years. And being shot at almost every day without our country doing anything about it. And so the president, in his earliest conversations with me, made it very clear that his wish was that we should never have American troops in Iraq except by invitation. A lot of people say, well, boy, you're sure a pro-Bush kind of guy. And actually, I am not. I'm actually intently independent, and I'm registered that way, and that's the way I think. But I do make the point that I think a lot of the handling of what Bush thought and what Bush said at certain points in time have been a bit unfair and a bit misleading, and this has been an interesting period in American history, and I did not find the guy overwhelmed with this notion of, well, we just have to hurry up and get in Iraq. I just didn't see it that way.
We went into Iraq without a UN coalition behind us, which we did have during the Gulf War. Do you think that the UN coalition would have helped or hindered militarily? And the reason why I ask that, I remember, I think it was a reporter on our show or policy analyst, I honestly don't remember who said this, who said that he understands that our military often feels it can move better without worrying about coordinating with a lot of other armies. Because other armies do things differently, and it can become a tactical problem to deal with that kind of coordination.
Coalition warfare is tough. I think Winston Churchill, during the dark days of World War II, made the observation that it's actually very difficult to work with allies. That the only thing worse would be to work without allies. I think the issue with regard to the United Nations and NATO, for that matter, is not so much their provision of troops for work inside Iraq or in Afghanistan, but rather how to command and control those forces once they're committed on the ground. Our experience with United Nations command and control, as you know, has not always been for us a rosy experience. One that pops into my mind is Mogadishu, Somalia.
So were you just as happy when you began the war in Iraq that you weren't working with the UN coalition?
I was pleased that we had the coalition that we had. I was pleased with the nations which were involved in our operations in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And actually, I was pleased that we had no overseeing United Nations command and control for the reasons you mentioned.
Those who have interacted with Saddam Hussein say that he was very mentally unstable, that he was a madman. What is it like to go into war believing that the person who is your opponent is mad?
Actually, Saddam Hussein was sufficiently in control of his military to be reckoned with as a commander of that military. And I think we're always not well served to think of the other guy as crazy, if you will. We just need to take a look at the adversary, and we need to treat him in accordance with his ability, and not necessarily what we think of his stability.
So, were you prepared for particularly kind of crazy or surprising scenarios because of Saddam Hussein and his loss of grasp of reality?
Absolutely. When this plan was being put together, people will ask from time to time, well, why did you use such a small force? Wouldn't we be much better off in terms of stability if we had a larger force on the ground right now? Wouldn't, in fact, we have been much better off had we had a larger force on the ground when we started the combat operation last March? And what I say is exactly the point you made. When you're dealing with a leader like Saddam Hussein, we should always ask ourselves, will this man leave his water infrastructure for the people in place while we build up a force of 500,000 men over 6 months, as we did in 1990? Well, would he leave his oil infrastructure in place, the future of the Iraqi people? Would he launch missiles in the direction of Israel if we were to be very visibly building up for 6 months? And so, for sure, Terry, it's very important to think about the psychology of the enemy, and we did so in this case. And in balance, that's where the decision came from to use the size of force that we had, because we were able to exercise a bit of surprise by going earlier than I think anyone anticipated.
I think perhaps the greatest criticism of the size of the force is about what happened after the official combat part of the operation. Mm-hmm. Critics say that we didn't have enough troops to win the peace, and you know we're still fighting an insurgency. In Iraq, the insurgency continues in spite of the fact that we handed over sovereignty back to the Iraqis. Mm-hmm. And the other criticism was that, you know, even earlier on, there weren't enough American troops to maintain law and order, prevent the museums and the office buildings and everything else from being looted, to stop chaos mm-hmm. and crime in the streets, and that the goodwill that perhaps we could have won. For a lot of people, we never won it because of the chaos, because they didn't really feel that their lives were improved, because their lives were in danger from suicide bombings and just, you know, street crime and so on. So in retrospect, do you think that the plan for American troops for the moment after the official fighting started wasn't adequate?
I think that the force structure was just right for the beginning of the operation, and I think beginning about the 1st of May last year, after the president announced that we had reached an endpoint for major combat operations, it was necessary to size up the situation on the ground. It's very interesting. When I started the operation, I kind of had a mental continuum, and on one end of the continuum, I saw, well, maybe the Iraqis will wrap their arms around their problem and will create a new Iraq very quickly without a great deal of violence and without a great deal of instability. On the other end of the continuum, maybe we see chaos and looting and continued violence and insurrection and so forth. And of course, Terry, there are a lot of points in between. Actually, when we initiated combat operations, we didn't know which of those two situations we would find. I've often thought how convenient it would be had we been able to find a man like Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan for Iraq. But unfortunately, there just was not such a leader available to do that. We saw what we saw with Ahmed Chalabi, and I think we just simply had to go through the process. And I think our government and certainly our young men and women in uniform have done a good job of adapting to what we have found as we've moved through that.
My guest is General Tommy Franks. He was the commander-in-chief of CENTCOM from July of 2000 to 2003 and led the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. His new memoir is called American Soldier. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is retired General Tommy Franks. He led the war in Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq. He was commander-in-chief of CENTCOM from July of 2000 to July 2003. In Bob Woodward's book about the war in Iraq, he says that that Powell and Cheney were barely speaking to each other during part of the planning of the war. And you write that on far too many occasions, the Washington bureaucracy fought like cats in a sack. You write this in your new book, American Soldier. I'm wondering how that kind of infighting affected you directly.
Boy, that's a great question. I think affecting me directly, not so much at all, affecting the planning that we had ongoing, perhaps not directly, but it was interesting. I didn't personally experience Colin Powell and Don Rumsfeld fighting. I actually never saw that, but I did see an inability of the bureaucracies within the State Department and down within the Defense Department. There was not a degree of cooperation that I would like to have seen in evidence as we went through it. These, I think, are huge personalities. These people are patriots to the last man and woman, but each has his own view. And I saw what I thought was a great deal of wedding to own view within our bureaucracy, rather than willing cooperation and coordination. Who's to say what overarching effect that may have had? I don't know, but I would like it if our bureaucracy in Washington didn't have so much friction. I'd be quick to point out that I've seen similar friction in large bureaucracies for decades, and I'm not sure that this is an immediate phenomenon. But we do have large personalities in Washington, and frequently they will contend with one another.
And three of the people who you single out for this kind of criticism of being inflexible in their commitment to their own ideas and being disruptive and divisive were mm-hmm. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, and Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Douglas Feith. And let me just read something you say about Feith. You say, Feith was a theorist whose ideas were often impractical. Among some uniformed officers in the building, he had a reputation for confusing abstract memoranda with results in the field. Feith was a master of the off-the-wall question that rarely had relevance to operational problems. It was obvious that Don Rumsfeld trusted him, and I wanted to use the products of his intellect, but I had little time or inclination to answer Feith's mind teasers, so I generally ignored his contributions and focused on what the secretary had to say. What kind of problems did what you perceived as inflexibility ideology have on your work? Did you have to?
What I meant, and what I'll stay with, is many discussions that we would have in defense on problem solving, what assumptions we might make, and so forth. Doug Feith was an out-of-the-box thinker. He is an out-of-the-box thinker, and so we'd be moving along talking about one particular aspect of the plan, and Doug Feith would say, well, how about this, or how about that? And in many cases, it is not that the ideas were necessarily bad ideas. They were just not sequitur with the discussion at hand and were not practically relevant to the subjects we'd be discussing. And so that's why I made the comment, and I'll stick with it. Doug, nice enough fella, patriot to be sure. But the master of the question that was not necessarily related to what we were talking about.
You described Donald Rumsfeld as demanding and impatient. Norman Schwarzkopf was critical of Rumsfeld and called his micromanagement of the war plan scary in the days during the planning of the war in Iraq. And this is something he told the Washington Post. He said, when Donald Rumsfeld makes his comments, it appears that he disregards the army, that he is the guy driving the train, and everybody else better fall in line behind him or else. There are guys at the Pentagon who have been involved in operational planning for their entire lives, and for this wisdom, acquired during many operations, wars, schools, for that just to be ignored and in its place have somebody who doesn't have any of the training is of concern. Did you share
that comment, Terry?
Norman Schwarzkopf to the Washington Post.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't share Norm's exact phrasing of the concern, but it's true that Don Rumsfeld is a very direct personality. He's a very direct, hands-on, centralized sort of a manager. Now there are some who take that as disrespect for uniformed leaders who, in fact, have given a great many years of their lives to learn their craft, and they're very, very good at it. And so it is not surprising to me to see people who actually don't know Don Rumsfeld all that well to make the sort of observation that you mentioned. On the other hand, I see him as perhaps one of the most focused men I've ever met. The degree of experience that he has inside the Washington bureaucracy is just enormous. I always respected him. There were times in our relationship where I would have found it hard to think of him as friend, although by and large I did think of him as friend. And he's a friend today, but I joke with people by saying, oh, you mean the smallish, mild-mannered gentleman with the very sharp elbows? And I would even go so far as to say, I think he has done our country a good job over the last several years, which, as you know, Terry, has been a really, really tough time to be inside the Washington bureaucracy.
If you're just joining us, my guest is retired General Tommy Franks. He was the Commander-in-Chief of CENTCOM from July 2000 to July 2003. He's written a new memoir called American Soldier. Let's talk a little bit about the actual strategy of the war in Iraq. First of all, you believed in the importance of deception, and one of the deceptions was called the Turkish deception. Would you describe what that was about?
Well, it's very interesting. Part of it having to do with Turkey, but the overarching deception notion was to prevent Saddam Hussein from ever determining where we would launch our major combat operations from. As long as it appeared as though we were going to be bringing major forces down through Turkey, that of course, was in our best interest. There was a period, and I mentioned this in the book, where we worked very hard to get Turkey to permit us to bring a large land force down through Turkey. But even when it became obvious that we were not going to receive diplomatic clearance and approval to do that, I wanted to maintain the appearance that we were. And so from time to time, we would pass to Saddam Hussein information that would indicate that the Turks actually were part of a large ruse and at the last minute were going to permit a large American force to come down through Turkey. The purpose of that was to nail down some 13 Iraqi divisions up north of Baghdad. We simply wanted them to remain in place in the north, rather than repositioning themselves down to the south where we would have to fight them. And so that's what the whole deception plan was all about. We wanted to confuse Saddam with respect to when we would attack and how we would attack.
How do you pass misinformation on to Saddam Hussein?
In a variety of ways. I mentioned some names in the book, but we actually used some friends who were heads of state in the Middle East and passed them information, knowing that they would pass some of that information to the regime in Baghdad. Did they know
that they were being used in that way? Were they cooperating, or were they unintentionally sending misinformation?
Very, very difficult to say. I think in some cases it was not set up as a double agent sort of approach. In other words, we would not go to one of these leaders and say, "Here's what we want you to pass to Saddam Hussein." We would rather indicate that we were interested in the north, for example, or that we were interested in Jordan to the west, and leave it to them what they would pass to the regime. Perhaps in the future, maybe 10 years, 15, 25 years from now, we'll be able to look back and see exactly what was passed and how it was passed, but that was a part of the approach that we used to keep Saddam guessing.
General Tommy Franks is the former commander-in-chief of CENTCOM. His new memoir is called American Soldier. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with General Tommy Franks. He was the commander-in-chief of CENTCOM from July 2000 to July 2003 and led the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. His new memoir is called American Soldier. I don't know if you feel like you could share this with us, but I'm wondering what went through your mind on the eve of the war, believing that your troops were going to be facing weapons of mass destruction, most likely biological. It's a terrible fate to be sending troops into, and you thought that that was what lay in store for them. So what goes through your mind right before the war starts?
Terry, that is that's such a good question, and it's an emotional question with me. I think that the hardest thing that anyone in authority ever has to do, and certainly the hardest thing any military leader ever has to do, is send the ones I call the kids. The generals get the credit, and the young people are doing the work. It's been that way all the way back through the Greatest Generation, the Band of Brothers, and so forth. When it comes time to make that decision and issue that order, that's a very, very difficult thing. And in my personal case, I just became very introspective. I absolutely believed in the mission that we had been given. I thought it was necessary to conduct this operation in Iraq, and I just steeled myself to the process. I make a point in the book that I learned from an older commander in Vietnam long, long years ago, that sometimes it's necessary to postpone one's emotions until you can afford them.
General Franks, what from your point of view, how did the experiment with embedded journalists work during the Iraq War?
Terry loved it. I loved it. I remember when Tory Clark first mentioned it to me. I said that idea is, in Texas parlance, dumber than a box of rocks. Think about the liability that the military will incur if we embed journalists, and on and on and on. And as I went through that and I thought more about it and I met some of the journalists and I thought about the process, I became the world's greatest fan. And I actually think the embedding of journalists in this operation was just a wonderful success story. On the one hand, you know, military commanders hate it when our citizens see all the warts on war. And war is a warty thing. On the other hand, there is a certain power in having our citizens know the truth. The embedding program was terrific.
Since so many Americans are now reading the September 11th Commission report, I want to ask you a couple of questions about September 11th. You say that on September 11th, you were given to believe that there might be up to 30 more attacks on the way. What were you preparing for, and what did you think might happen?
The context of that is actually quite interesting. We had, as has been reported, we'd been concerned for some period of time about a terrorist attack, but actually our concern was in the Middle East. The indicators that we had indicated potential problems in a number of countries for which I was responsible and in which I had 19,000 to 20,000 American troopers under my command. And so at the time that 9/11 happened, and all of the fury of intelligence reporting started and indicating a possibility of additional attacks, my focus was on the Middle East. I was worrying about our American troopers that were over in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, and so forth. So that's what we were focused on at the same time that I was worrying and thinking about Afghanistan, because I suspected that we were going to go into Afghanistan to remove al-Qaeda.
On September 11th, President Bush was at an elementary school in Texas, and he was in the classroom listening to the children read a book called My Pet Goat, as he was told by Andrew Card, I believe it was, that a second plane had hit the World Trade Center and America was under attack. After getting that message, the president continued to sit for about 7 more minutes as the children continued to read My Pet Goat. What is your reaction to that?
Some
people have said he froze, that he was needed, that even if it was too soon for him to move anywhere, that he should have gotten on the phone and started to get in touch immediately with his people. So I'm wondering, as a military leader yourself, what was your reaction to that?
Terry, that's tough. I wish that just being candid, I wish we didn't have to have such vitriol, not yours and mine, but when we have election years and that sort of thing, and we find that that an observation like that creates so much discussion. I really don't know what I think about the 7 minutes. I know in my personal case, and in decisions that I have been asked to make or thought it was my duty to make over time, many of them that I have made very, very quickly have turned out to be wrong. And I have found that a little bit of time at the beginning of an issue or the beginning of a problem can pay large dividends in outcomes. And so I can't be in Bush's head while he was receiving that information and knowing what he was thinking about. But despite the fact that I actually ain't a Republican hack, I don't hold against him that he took some time to do some serious thinking. I think it was a very tough moment for America, and I don't know what I would have done in that position.
You think there's a chance you might have gone back to your seat in the classroom and stayed for a while the kids continue to read?
I actually do. There are a couple of kinds of leadership style. One is the kind that immediately wants to begin issuing instructions, and the other kind is one that has intense confidence and faith in the people right around you. When I was the commander-in-chief, I had security people and operators and intelligence people around me all the time. And in times of crisis, frequently you can just watch them work and satisfy yourself that they are getting the information that needs to be gotten together for good decision-making. And so I don't know exactly what the situation was in that school. I've read an awful lot about it. And of course, Michael Moore's work, Fahrenheit 9/11, and has raised that as an issue. Don't know whether it's an issue or not. I'd have trouble grading someone's paper on that particular point.
Just curious, did you see Michael Moore's movie?
I have not seen it. I've read an awful lot about it and talked to a number of friends, some of whom live right here in New York, about the movie, and I will see it.
Interesting. Tell me why you're going to see it, because I think a lot of people are some people are refusing to see it.
Oh, I think it's interesting. I find it hard to talk to people who would refuse to see 9/11 or who would refuse to listen to what Rush Limbaugh has to say on an issue. I think I think far too frequently we want everything to be in hyperbole. And I don't think life is hyperbole. I think while we go through life on somewhat of a sine wave with our highs and with our lows, that reality of life in this country is somewhere in the middle of the scale. And I just like to be advised about what's going on both ends of the extreme.
You each chapter in your memoir, American Soldier, begins with a quote about war. And I want to end the interview with one of those quotes. You quote Sun Tzu, who says, "If you know your enemy and know yourself, you need not fear the result of 100 battles." What does that mean to you?
Let me use the example of technologies, and something that people ask me about from time to time: the Powell Doctrine and the use of overwhelming force, and why didn't we do that in Iraq or for that matter in Afghanistan? And what I say is, I use the Sun Tzu quote: we have an ability right now to know ourselves, to understand where our troops are, what they're doing, what their levels of supply are, that we have never had before. That is a technologically enhanced capability that simply is just world class. Similarly, the closer we get to understanding what the enemy's capabilities are, then the less fear we need to have in the use of fewer troops in order to accomplish any given mission. So on the one hand, we're technologically capable of knowing our own condition, the friendly condition on a battlefield. But as everything would indicate to all of us, we still have a long way to go to understand the intentions of the enemy. Now, we have a lot of capability to photograph enemy troops and know where those troops are, but we don't yet have the capability to understand their intentions. I think Sun Tzu was talking about that 2,500 years ago, and I think it's just remarkable that it's as true today as it was then.
General Franks, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're the best. Thanks a lot. It's a treat to be with you.
General Tommy Franks is the former commander-in-chief of CENTCOM. His new memoir is called American Soldier.